It was very good news to see that the case that the NTU took Sydney University to court over was successful for the NTU. Can you give my listeners some understanding of the intellectual freedom protection that was given by the court?
I'll try and keep this brief, but it's a little complicated. There is a difference between what people would call freedom of speech and the idea of academic or intellectual freedom in a university. Because academic or intellectual freedom in a university context is actually about the freedom of people who work in academic areas to be able to engage in debate and discussion about issues in their discipline without fear or favour. That they should be able to have a debate about anything from the medical matters to physics through to the matters of identity and politics.
This is core university business, right?
Well, it is, and if you don't have those sorts of things, it corrupts universities very significantly. For example, you wouldn't want to have a corporation decide that because it pays a lot of money to a university, it ought to get the results that it wants. And being able to interfere with the if the university entity is able to be persuaded by a corporate entity that they ought to find certain results, and that then impacts on an academic's work, then that would be disastrous, not only for the integrity of the institution, but also for the society as a whole. We don't want to know that pharmaceutical results are a function of who pays for the research, and that the academics need to be free to ensure that they are giving honest assessment of the situation in their professional opinion. So these are very important principles for the underlying nature of higher education, and in particular around research, but not only. So we had a particular case, and from the union's point of view, we find ourselves most often, but not always, having to defend people in a situation where there's a controversy. Something happens that makes it difficult to defend. And from our point of view, we have to defend the principle, regardless of what we think of the merits or otherwise of what someone's had to say. Because if you're not prepared to defend the people that you don't agree with, then you're not going to be in a position to defend the people you do agree with when the time comes. So from our point of view, it's a very important principle that we have to uphold.
So what was going on was someone one of your members was going to be chastised by Sydney University, and it was a bone of contention, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, it's slightly harsher than that. Tim Anderson was basically dismissed from the university because of a range of things, but it included quite dramatic images of a swastika laid over the top of an Israeli flag. And there were other related issues associated with it. But it was done within the context, certainly from our point of view, which is the reason we took up the issue, that was done within the context of his professional and academic engagement. And so the university dismissed him. We took it to court and were shocked and found ourselves in a very, very serious situation when the courts found that the university's code of conduct overrode the provisions that we understood we had negotiated in the collective agreement. Now, that's a very serious concept, because the code of conduct is a policy of the university, and policies, by their nature, can be changed. They're not necessarily subject to negotiation. We might be consulted, but at the end of the day, the university can have a code of conduct, within reason, in terms that they prefer.
And they're changeable depending on the wind.
That's right, and the fact that they are subject to change means that it undermines the principle of academic freedom. We appealed to a full bench of the Federal Court about that decision and got a result, as you've already indicated, that was much better from our point of view. It basically reinforced the fact that the clause itself did protect academic freedom. It reinforced the primacy of the collective agreement over policies of the university, and in particular the code of conduct. While it hasn't yet dealt with the question of whether or not Tim Anderson has acted within his rights as an academic, it sent it back to the other court, back to the judge who originally heard it, and said, "Well, you need to reconsider your findings based upon these principles." And it basically said that, first of all, that the collective agreement has got primacy. Secondly, that the provisions in the collective agreement did provide genuine protection for academic freedom for staff in the university. And thirdly, that, you know, these things are not constrained by popularity. Just because something's unpopular doesn't mean that someone's not doing it in their capacity as an academic seeking to engage with the issue at stake. So from our point of view, it was a very, very a positive and important decision for the union to achieve.
And your members, I would say.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this has implications. The original decision had implications for all university staff across the whole sector. It brought into question many of the conditions that we had understood that we had negotiated in our agreements across the country. So this was a very important decision from our members' point of view.
And in relation to Tim, what hangs in the balance is if it would be deemed that he was expressing himself in accordance with scholarly norms.
Something like that, yes. I mean, academic freedom is not an unfettered right. It has limitations built within it. You don't have the right to harass or vilify people in what you say or do, but it does protect speech and the contest of ideas to a large extent. And what it does say is that you have to be able to negotiate. You know, just because you might cause somebody offence doesn't mean that you're not acting as an academic in an academic freedom context. Now, Tim's fate is not yet fully determined, because the court, the original judge, has to go back and reconsider his dismissal, his approval of the dismissal in light of the decision of the full bench. So basically he has to go back and have another look at the case. So we will have to still have a look at Tim's particular circumstances.
The NTU have in the past had to support academics that people will be quite aware of, Peter Reed, Ros Ward in particular.
Ros Ward, that's right.
Yep. Yep. I mean, particularly because Ros, for example, fell foul of political
interference. Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it's very important in terms of the work of staff in universities that they have that they're not able to be censored for political purposes as well as for other corporate purposes that I've indicated here.
There's a couple of other things. I know that it's not quite the same thing, but it is on slightly on the same sort of agenda. And I've always been interested in something that someone told me, an academic from RMIT told me, that in their EBA, the university insisted that they have to around conduct, and that they were expected to smile, and I thought that's such a bizarre expectation from an employer.
Yeah, and that gives you an idea of the sorts of difficulties, that sort of things that might go into a code of conduct. While we might object to it, we can't prevent the university from amending a thing like a code of conduct, but we do have a capacity to prevent that from being put into a collective agreement. That becomes, you know, that so that that is the important point. And as I say, because it has in effect the force of federal law, our understanding, which the courts have now confirmed, is that an enterprise agreement or a collective agreement overrides an internal document of the institution.
It may not have reached your desk yet, but it may have already. But the it's been reported that the University Foreign Interference Task Force, which has been looking into the business about wanting to, and there's been lots of pushback about it, but this idea that they want to be able to get academic staff to tell detailed information about over 10 years of their political affiliations as well as whatever their funding has been for their studies. This is quite intrusive.
It is very intrusive, and for the very reasons that we've just been talking about, it's entirely inappropriate. I mean, people's political affiliations should not be influencing decisions about their employment or the funding of research that might get done. The universities are important points and low places for independent thought and independent inquiry. If it's subject to political interference and funded, based on political considerations, then that really interferes with the mission of a university and its role within our society. I mean, you will listen to the radio every day and you will hear academics talking on matters related to wide scope of issues, you know, whether they be health issues or international issues or whatever. You might hear a dozen academics on any given radio station in any given day. And it's that independent voice that makes them so valuable to the community.
The other thing that you've pointed out is that you say to universities that they probably should stop being so obsessed with their branding, which I find very interesting. Do you want to talk on that subject?
Well, I think, you know, there are all sorts of problems that the university sector is now currently facing, you know, that are a function of the corporatization of the sector, where they are treating themselves as corporations more than they are as institutions of independent inquiry. And that has some very serious implications for the community as a whole. Now, one small part of that has been the reliance, which has been encouraged by both sides of politics, on international students for the funding of many of our activities within the universities. And that has driven the universities in many cases to make decisions based upon bringing that income in. As I say, that's been encouraged by government because that's a way of them offloading their responsibility to fund the sector. But the corrosive effect on the institutions, it's not the international students themselves, because they have something a significant contribution to the institutions by virtue of their presence. But it is corrosive. The over-reliance on the income does mean that the institutions start to behave in ways that are more interested in protecting their income, furthering the mission of the institution themselves. And they become more and more corporate in their outlook and the way in which they engage. Now, a lot of that has come home to roost, of course, through the COVID period, at many of our members' cost. There are thousands upon thousands of jobs that have been lost as a consequence of this, and to be fair, also as a consequence of the federal government's failure to properly come in and assist the sector and provide sufficient funding. As a consequence, we are seeing thousands of jobs going across the sector, and it's a deeply concerning set of circumstances. And not finished yet.
No. Last week we heard that 200 or so staff members were being cut from Deakin down here. And also, obviously, the agenda of the federal government in its methodology was shown in the job seeker payment given to private universities but not to public universities. So
yeah,
it's
precisely.
A favouritism process going on. If we go back to Tim Anderson's case, Tim must have had tenure, and that indicates an issue around increasing casualisation of staff. People that I might add have invested huge amounts of money and time to get their credentials to be able to teach at university level are now being paid a pittance and given scrawny hours for years on end.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the sector has become reliant upon an underclass of employee, people who have been paid poorly. Universities have not paid proper attention to how they've been paid, what they've been paid. And in many cases, universities have devolved the decision-making from the centre to the individual academic. And the individual academic gets told, here's your budget, do what you can with it. And in effect, what the university is saying to them is, we want you to cheat your casuals because we can't give you enough money for you to properly employ them, but you need to do what you can with this amount of money. And so that actually has created a culture within the sector of an over-reliance on casual labour and the exploitation of that labour. And a lot of that has come out very significantly over the last few years. You will have seen wage theft claims coming up at many universities at the moment. The casualisation of the sector has suddenly become an issue that, well, put it this way, we've been trying to raise the issue and talk about the issue for 10, 15 years or longer. And it's only recently that it's suddenly become a hot topic issue. And once again, I think COVID has put a real spotlight on what's been going on, because of course those people are the most vulnerable people who get put aside when the institutions are under financial difficulty.
Well, it's sort of interesting to me because if we go back to the branding and the obsession around the 500 top universities in the world, which is one of the things that Melbourne University obviously clearly wishes to, and other Sydney University, the other ones that are a top tier in our sphere, are their structures being weakened by this?
I think they have been. I mean, I don't want to pretend that our universities are not strong still. They are. They are. There is still. The university sector is going to come out of the current environment different from what it went into. It is going to be changed by the experience of COVID. And it's going to have to do a whole series of re-evaluations. Of how they do their business and what's going on, partly because of issues associated with casualisation no longer being acceptable, not only within the sector but in the community more broadly. Casualisation has become more contested in the broader community as well as within universities. But also the funding model for the sector is going to have to be fundamentally reshaped. And the federal government is not going to be able to walk away from its responsibilities. The difficulty is, while you might have 1 year when you don't have new students coming in, talking about international students now, each year that goes by, you not only have the loss of income from that group of students that's coming in that year, you also lose the students who would have enrolled last year but didn't. And are now no longer going into second year because they weren't there in first year. So it becomes a compounding issue. Students will be at university from anywhere between, well, 3 years and in some cases 10 years, but for the most part, let's call it a 3 year feeder. So each year that goes by, you not only have to deal with the loss of income from that year, you're also compounding that because the previous year's students. There weren't sufficient of them to feed through either, so it starts to build. And the difficulties that the sector's got is financially going to be continuing beyond this year. Next year is going to be another difficult year as well.
Just to finish up, have you been getting your members talking to you about overwork? Because if they're cutting, then they must be overworking the existing staff.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Workloads and casualisation are the two big issues that for most staff in the sector. And I think as jobs go, Our fear and our concern is that many people are going to have to pick up the load of the people who've gone. And just because people leave the sector doesn't mean that the work suddenly disappears. So, you know, these are very big issues, and we're about to start a bargaining round, or have started a bargaining round at the moment. So these will all be issues that will get talked about on campus over the next next year or so.